Thanks for taking the time to download this BBC Radio 5 Live podcast. To find other programmes you might be interested in, click bbc.co.uk/5live, where you'll also find our terms of use.
Welcome to the BBC's flagship film programme. Here's a new feature that we start with, where we comment about items on the news. First of all, we're not interested in doing the one show, are we, Mark?
No, we're not. We weren't approached. We weren't asked about it. That's the official version, isn't it?
Yeah, I think that's the official version.
Obviously, bacon schmaken, but, you know, the fact is, you know, we weren't asked, we weren't approached, and we didn't turn it down, did we?
No, I think Charles Hawtrey and an orc presenting the one show isn't going to work for anybody.
I think that would be great.
Do you think?
I think that would be fantastic.
Do we secretly want it, then?
Do we secretly want it? That sounds like the tailors out of, you know, do you secretly want it, sir?
Well, I think we better, you know, start the campaign now. I think you two, fabulous.
Could you just remind me, what is the one show?
It's a TV show on at 7.
And what do they talk about films?
They talk about all sorts of things. They might talk more about films if you were on.
David Hepworth, the great music journalist, once said, because he's often invited on, as he is, to comment about music matters. He says he's never completed a sentence yet. Well, I mean, because you get halfway through, it's so much of a hurry. Thanks, you're halfway through one phrase. That's enough. We move on. Next feature.
Great. Well, that sounds ideal. We never complete sentences.
So we're not interested in that.
No.
And also, Julian Fellowes, Life Peerage. He's one of those people you kind of assumed he always.
I thought he was
one.
I thought he was a lord. Yes. I mean, he certainly, you know, he has the manner and the gravitas. I did
They should have a hereditary peerage just for him.
I did an on-stage thing with him talking about, I think it was the Duchess. And he has a regal presence. You know, he walks into the room and you imagine that there should be a train of people behind him, you know, with trays and Rolls Royces. He's like the living, breathing equivalent of a stately home.
That's the last of our regular features where we comment about
on
the news. I don't think it would get very far. Justine, thank you. Very good. Good bulletin. So it's
I can't believe you just did that.
No,
you're going to compliment the news. Good news.
Well
good,
read.
Well done. Good news today. You know, she doesn't write
she's
the
gold,
news.
A gold star reader. She knows the way she read it. She performed it well.
Oh, I thought you were complimenting her on the good quality of news.
No,
today.
It was a performance. Best leading lady in a news performance. So on the programme, reviews for Harry Potter. That'll be on.
Mm-hmm.
Plus, our code of conduct will be issued officially and formally. Just after 3 o'clock.
So is 3 o'clock the launch moment?
I think it's when we are going to perform it.
Are we going to interrupt ourselves to go over live to ourselves launching
something
the code
like
of
that.
Conduct?
Something like that.
And we should say something about how the code of conduct has been put together.
Well, basically we're taking the glory from all the work being done by listeners who've sent in various ideas, and we've assembled them in some kind of rough order, and we published them.
We did have a meeting.
There was a meeting in which we decided what to do.
Well, no, there was a meeting when we went, you go through that pile, I'll go through this pile. There we go. But it's now very fine, top 10 list of things not to do, and it's been beautifully laminated.
Eagle-eyed viewers who can watch, of course, because this is a live broadcast as well, you can have pictures. bbc.co.uk/...
Which Jason forgot, apparently.
Yes, Jason Isaacs forgot and was much taken to... Hello, Jason.
Hello, Jason.
Much taken to task by his wife, amongst others, for looking as though he might be a mugger. But if you're eagle-eyed and if the camera's pointing in the right direction, you can see a full poster laminated version, which is, as we said to Rachel earlier, how it will come... When you print it off, it will come down laminated.
I love the way you did that. It's like the... Is it the Sarah Jessica Parker character in L.A. Story when she says, what do you do? She says, I point at things for a living. And you did that with a little bit of a flourish.
Dear Green Eggs and Ham, this is Geraint Bowen. No worthy exceptional honours. Whilst we've all been away, I was wondering whether Mr. Stephen Woolley has succeeded in his attempt to convince the BBFC to reduce the classification of his film Made in Dagenham from the dreaded 15 to 12A. Can someone please immediately notify me if this ever happens so that I can begin my quest to reduce the certificate of South Park bigger, longer and uncut? If 15 to 20 words of profanity are acceptable for children to sit through, then 399 occasions should also be acceptable. I can also provide a solid argument to decrease the certificate of South Park in a similar manner to that of Mr. Woolley, in that the film tackles issue of censorship and a proportion of the language is justified.
It does also have a major world leader in bed with Satan.
Does that guarantee a 15 certificate?
I would think usually it probably does. There was a wonderful thing, because with South Park, when Blame Canada was Oscar nominated, and Robin Williams had to come on stage at the Oscars and sing the toned down version of Blame Canada.
This
they're not even a real country anyway.
David Ball, BSc Honours, dear Linda and Alice, I'd like to thank the good doctor for a wonderfully exciting evening yesterday at the Northern Stage in Newcastle. Brackets, Geordie dialect optional, thank you. On a purely personal level, I'd like to thank him due to my current man flu symptoms, as I was overheating on row one, and it was only due to his excessive flappy hand action during a response to a question about movie piracy that I managed to avoid passing out. So thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.
On the same subject, Stuart
Riding. You coming tonight?
Stuart Riding wants to know why your shoes are so scruffy. Have you not cleaned them since you got back from the New Forest?
No. You
can see some of your live shows and they're very tatty.
Yeah, they are. You coming tonight?
Don't know, really.
North Finchley. I mean, it's so near. It's almost where you live.
I find it's quite a long way away, really. The Code of Conduct, which we're going to do at 3 o'clock. Here is one email which really puts into... It's just an email, but it explains why we're doing it. Because there are some people who say... Look, you know, just hang loose, just chill. It doesn't matter. Here's an email from John Bell. Dear young Nehampkin and old Nehampkin, I realise this
Right, do you get that?
No.
Love and Death.
Oh, no, which is...
Yeah, and the fact that old Nehampkin was younger than young Nehampkin, no one had ever quite figured out how that happened.
This is why we're doing it, OK? Thank you, John, for this. I recently took my two daughters to see Despicable Me and came across a living, breathing manifestation of everything that annoys me about other people at the cinema. On entering the screening room, I noticed a lady sitting in a seat next to ours with coats and bags on the floor in front of her and on the seat next to her, which was our seat. Oh no, I bet those bags are full of sweets, I thought as we approached. I wasn't to be disappointed. I hesitated, expecting said bags to be lifted to A, let us pass, and B, let my daughter sit down. But no, the lady was too busy eating. So we sidled, passing, stepping over the first few sets of bags, and then I had to point out that the other set of bags were on one of our seats. She didn't speak, presumably because her mouth was full, but gave me a look that suggested I had just scoffed her remaining confectionery. But the offending bags were begrudgingly removed and we sat down ready to be entertained. We were happy. A father with his daughters on holiday, together, looking forward to a fun family film. And then it started. Not the film, not yet, but the breaking of every single entry that I hope will end up on our code of conduct list. Points at poster.
Very good.
First, there was the talking during the Coming Soon trailers. Then, once the film started, the eating increased. Noisy bagged eating, interspersed with noisy talking. That was accompanied by the drinking. Loud, slurpy drinking, embellished by that popping sound that you get when drinking from a bottle that you've sucked the air out of. Schlop. Then the mobile came out.
No schlopping. We should have had that.
No, we should. Then the mobile phone came out and texting ensued.
No!
To top it all, about 30 minutes in, and clearly because of the amount of liquid she was consuming, the toilet visits started. Now, we were positioned three seats in from the side next to the stairs. So did she get up and use those stairs? I think you know the answer to that one. No, she squeezed past us and the whole row to get to the stairs on the other side, and I counted four visits. I was starting to think this was a test, something that maybe the two good doctors had put in place to qualify entries for the code of conduct list. The most complaints go in, but no, it was just Simon's sheer hell. It continued throughout the length of the film, causing my six-year-old daughter to cuddle into me tighter and tighter to get away from this personification of cinematic annoyance.
Evil.
So much so that I could have saved £6 and only bought two seats. That is why we're doing it.
Yeah, exactly. That's exactly why we're doing it. I wonder whether on the sort of third time of the going to the toilet in the Jack, you know, the old Jack Warner rule that he used to judge movies by how many times he had to go to the loo, under which basis Bonnie and Clyde was a 3P picture, whether the row couldn't have just got together as one and refused to let said person back in.
Just a word on the podcast. An interesting point. So the whole code will be done and officially...
3 o'clock.
At 3 o'clock.
I think it's the headline news.
Helen, do you think it'll make the news?
I think it will make the news.
And they'll probably clip us for the 4 o'clock news.
I certainly hope so.
Be you disappointed know if it doesn't happen.
I see that you're in charge of the news, so surely you can do it, can't you? You said good news. It could have been better if it had a Whittertainment update in it.
I'll suggest that.
Go ahead.
Helen in Gloucester, just on the podcast, which is usually available very soon after the programme. Mm-hmm. Could someone please explain to the Radio 5 Live announcer lady how podcasts work? I don't need to be thanked at the beginning of every podcast for taking the time to download this podcast. In fact, as I've already got it subscribed, frankly, it would be more of an effort to unsubscribe than to keep downloading it.
That's hence the constantly increasing podcast figures. It's just so hard
really,
to
really
stop.
Really, thanks for just bearing with us and not unsubscribing. We will suggest that is the due script. Coming next, we have our first guest.
Jeremy Thomas. Sorry, I think there was just a big pause there. I wonder whether I was meant to be completing that sentence.
The award-winning Jeremy Thomas is going to talk about production and his career in film in just a few moments' time. Is that right? You're looking at me as though I've forgotten something.
No, that's perfectly right. I'm just looking at you in awe at your multitasking skills.
Is that right? This text says, my 10-year-old son wants me to take him to see Harry Potter and the Deadly Harolds. Which is...
Harry Potter and the Deadly Harold and Maud's.
That would be some show.
Hal Ashby takes on J.K. Rowling.
Stephen Parfitt wants to know if you would have slammed Peeping Tom if you were reviewing it in 1960.
Well, as the person who's standing up for Last House on the Left and getting it in the neck for that kind of thing, I tend to think that I would have been one of the people manning the barricade saying that it's a great movie, because whatever else you may think about my film reviews, I do tend to like the darker side of movies.
That is certainly true. Hello, Oscar-winning producer Jeremy Thomas. How are you?
Very well, thank you very much.
When was the first time you saw Peeping Tom? Do you remember?
Probably in the 60s, late 60s.
Do you remember what you thought of it?
Well, I was precocious in my choice, and I love those sort of films. And in fact, I saw it at the National Film Theatre first, because it certainly wasn't available on DVD those days.
Were you outraged at all? Do you understand why people were outraged?
I understand why people were outraged, but people are still outraged by anything. The shock of the new is still there. And this film had a sort of psychological side to it, which disturbed people very much. And in fact, whilst I've been waiting to come and hear a new film called A Serbian Film, and it's outraging people. People still can get outraged by films to the extreme, as they have been for some of my films like Crash. It outraged people. It's been banned in Westminster, can't be shown in Westminster, but it's now available on Channel 4 at 8 o'clock at night.
Has the Westminster ban on Crash, because just if people have forgotten this, because it seems like very recent history to me, when David Cronenberg's Crash came out, it played at the London Film Festival, he met one of the government ministers who apparently said to him, how old are you? That was the extent of their conversation. The next thing was that there was a declaration in the press that the film was potentially depraving and corrupting, and Westminster Council demanded to have a look at it and then banned it.
Well, the truth of the matter, that minister was Virginia Bottom.
That's right.
And
thank
she
you.
Didn't see it. And the person who banned it, Councillor John Bull, in his wisdom, who licensed dog stands and cinemas at the time, he also didn't see it. So
on what grounds did Westminster Council decide? I mean, somebody at Westminster Council must have seen it.
Votes. I mean, the votes counted at that time. It was something which could be taken, J.G. Ballard's Crash, and the sexual opportunity of a car crash seemed to be something which was easy to say this film should be banned.
So it was genuinely the case that the people who took the decision to ban it had not seen it?
Genuinely the case. Of course, some people saw the film. The British Board of Film Censorship, who were meant to be our censors, gave it an uncut certificate, 18. But in their wisdom, the people who hadn't seen it thought that people who were over 18 couldn't see it.
Well, actually, the BBFC report is incredibly thorough. They went to some trouble to check out all the accusations that had been made against it and published a very, very thorough explanation saying not only have we not cut this, but we have tested all the accusations against it and find none of them to be true, either legally or in terms of the BBFC guidelines.
I mean, there was hypocrisy involved in that, but, there was vote-getting at that moment, and that particular area of votes they were getting wanting to ban Crash, but even it went to the front pages of the Daily Mail and front pages of the
Evening Standard.
Beyond the film, beyond the bounds of depravity. God rest Alexander Walker's...
Although, as Alex himself said, he never said that. That was the headline.
We haven't invited you in to talk about Crash specifically, but...
But since I'm here, I thought I might as well do.
Exactly. And Jeremy's here because he's being honoured by the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences. Special tribute on the 25th of November. What happens on the 25th, Jeremy? Do you know?
Well, I think it's somewhere between a roast and a tribute, because they invite people you've worked with over the decades to come and talk about you, and the Academy, people from the Academy come from America, and it's sort of the producers' branch of the Academy decided that that I was to have some sort of tribute, and I readily accepted that.
I have a list here which of people who they're expecting to come along, which includes Angelica Houston, Keira Knightley, John Hurt, Ben Kingsley, Tom Conti, Michael Fassbender, Stephen Frears, Ken Loach. This is all pretty good, isn't it, really? Is there anyone else I should have mentioned who's sort of said RSVP'd?
I don't know who's coming, really, exactly.
Have I just spoiled it for you? Was that a secret?
They're all on stage with him.
Yeah, but, I'm going to find out who they are before, because they're going to be probably embarrassing me from the stage.
But you say it's a bit like a roast. I chaired one of these when Terry Gilliam had his, and I mean there was a certain amount of ribbing involved, but it was generally a discussion of his career with some clips from his career, and then people in the audience asking extremely appreciative questions. Of course, being Terry, he managed to turn many of those questions into an excuse to be rude about people in that wonderful way that he does. But it was very, very positive experience.
Well, I was one of the people talking about Terry, having worked with him, and I certainly gave him a bit of a roast, but, you know, that was just the way I approached it.
Do they show clips, and if so, what clips would you like them to show? If it was down to you, Jeremy, if the films that you are most proud of, what would you like them to be including?
Well, I'd like them to include a film that I did called The Shout, which was directed by a great Polish director called Jerzy Skolimowski, which I did in the 77. I'd like them to include Bad Timing, Nicholas Rogue. I'd like to include Merry Christmas, Mr. Lawrence, Oshima. I'd like them to include The Last Emperor. I'd like them to include Sexy Beasts and Crash, Naked Lunch. In fact, a lot of the movies that I've been involved with, I'd like them to include. You know,
was the Last Emperor the most sort of garlanded film from that list?
Yeah, it was a film that sort of appealed because it was sort of epic. We never realised when we were making that film that it would turn into that, but it was something that was appreciated very much by the Academy, especially as the Academy contains people who have been making films all their lives, and the film had a lot of wonderful collaborators on it, and they chose that film that year.
Can I ask you, I mean, I think one of the intriguing things about your role in the production of that is that, I mean, if I've got this right, it took 3 years to get together, it was independently financed. That sounds like an extraordinary achievement, to get that amount of money to deliver that film, which then went on to get all those awards, and to do it independently.
It is unusual because, you know, the cinema today is industrialised, and the independent cinema, which I am an independent producer, it's very unusual and hard to get a film of that size made and up on the screen and into the cinemas all over the world. I couldn't do it today, without a doubt. It would be impossible for me to make a film like that.
Why is that?
Well, a film which is 100% Chinese, except for a few lines from Peter O'Toole, a film directed by, at that time, a director who had made Last Tango in Paris, Band, and La Luna, it would just be an impossible idea. And, of course, to me, Bertolucci was the great filmmaker to make this film. And we made the film because China wanted us to make this film, which was the story of the Son of Heaven, the absolute ruler of a quarter of the world's population, who died as a gardener. So they thought there was nothing better than an English film crew or British film crew and Italian film crew would come to tell this story, which was like an advert for, you can be an emperor, but you can be happier as a gardener. So they gave us open door. They brought us and they allowed us to go into the Forbidden City. And the timing was everything. At the same time, the British banks wanted to find a way in to make business in China. So I'd met a banker, in fact, through going through the Yellow Pages, America's and DeLawrence, I was looking to get some money. And my partner said, listen, you know, let's look for a bank. And we looked through Yellow Pages, found a bank, Hill Samuel, went to see a junior banker there, who then became a senior banker by the time really we were going to make The Last Emperor. Went back to him and he said, well, in fact, we're trying to get to China. And if you take me to China and show me that you've got all this, we'll find you the banks. And that's, I mean, it sounds a bit glib and easy. Mm. It was very hard, but that's what happened, basically.
One of the reasons that wouldn't get made now is that the Chinese probably would want to send a different message. You know, you might want to be a gardener, but think what it would be great.
You could become an emperor.
To become an emperor, or at least a CEO of a big company and make millions.
Well, you can go into the shopping mall, that's for sure. And when I went back to China recently, where there were beautiful fields, there was some shopping malls bigger than Westfield, you know.
And I know this keeps coming up again and again. In terms of the current state of play in the absence or otherwise of the UK Film Council, it seems to me that all the attention has been towards how difficult it is to make films in the UK. But actually, I think the main problem is the distribution of those films. Do you think what's happened since the announcement about the UK Film Council is as disastrous as everybody says it is? What practical impact is it going to have?
Films will continue to be made, but, you know, do we want only burgers on the high street, or do we want some fish and chips in paper and vinegar? So we do need some sort of support of our business, which is sort of annihilated by the fact that we've got the same language. We speak American in England or Britain. We speak American. And other countries like France, Italy, Germany, they've got their own language to protect them. So we need some help to continue some sort of national cinema, which is under siege because our outlets are all owned by foreign forces, and I'm not that I'm anti-Hollywood or anti-anything at all. I just want to get some opportunity to get my films shown in an ambience where piracy, which people have grown up with the idea that everything's free on the internet, and I see my films before they even open downloaded 20,000-30,000 times, and it's very, very hard to get the money back for a film that costs a lot of money and you spend a lot of money in the marketing. Then people steal it, and there's nobody who knows who can't go into a pub on a Friday night and buy the latest DVD for a pound. So there needs to be some sort of law or some sort of help for us that we can actually go and, you know, if somebody steals something from you, you can actually get your money back. And in France they're starting, and I hope in their wisdom they'll focus on that so that we can at least get some return for from our films in the age when it seems to be socially acceptable to steal any
but
signal.
When, there was a piece on the news just a couple of days ago, Jeremy, which you probably saw about how the latest Harry Potter film, which we'll be reviewing later, how lots of that has turned up online and Warners are horrified. Given the amount of security and the money that they will have spent on protecting this extraordinary new film that they've got, if they can't do it, it's a losing battle.
It's something the hardware companies are involved in that, and of course I didn't come on the program to talk about that, but this is true. The hardware companies started giving us DVD players that you could make a copy, exact copy, as good as the other copy, clone. So people can, you get 10 of those players, you can make 20 high speed copies of a film in an hour. So one person buys something, and they can, you know, just for the cost of a disc, they can get out many. Plus, the computers are designed that they can easily download films, and there needs to be, the hardware companies are also involved in allowing that to happen, and there has to be some sort of global movement on this, or else there'll be no more new, fresh movies made.
Dominic, on this email, what advice can Jeremy give to independent filmmakers that don't have an agent and are trying to get funding for their films? Which kind of taps into some of what you were talking about earlier. But if you haven't got the reputation, if you haven't got the back catalogue, but you do want to be an independent filmmaker, what do you do?
Make your movie. I mean, people make films on iPhones today, and you know, you look at films like The Blair Witch Project, which is made for $50,000. I mean, an idea, a great idea, normally gets made and gets out, but there are very few great ideas. Plus, there are very, very few gifted people, and if you happen to be one of those gifted people with a great idea, you will get your idea made, as modest or not. And if you look at something recently, like a film like Shifty, that was made under a scheme, the microwave scheme, mm-hmm. through Film London, I think it was made for under £100,000. Sounds like a lot of money, but it can be raised, probably. And Film London, I think, put up half the money of that from these. And then directors now making film in Hollywood.
So, but equally, you look at something like Gareth Edwards' Monsters, which was made for, you know, $500,000, which looks, in terms of its, you know, its special effects, its camera work, it looks like a great big special effects movie that just happens to be a small independent movie that's actually more of a road movie than a monster movie. I mean, he made that in his front room, virtually.
We've got the equipment. The equipment today is so different. What you can make the film on. You can make a film that can be shown in a cinema on equipment that you can buy for a few £1,000s. You know, the camera can be bought, the editing equipment, which is completely different than in the past when you couldn't even get hold of this equipment and go to laboratories. So it has changed completely, and in fact it's probably the best time ever it's ever been. It's never been a better time to make the films. The showing the films and the distribution of these films is what is very difficult, because the cinemas are completely dominated with the men films part 1 to 7, you know, and it's very hard for us to get the independent films, the unusual films, the original films onto the screens.
What are you working on at the moment?
I'm working on a film with David Cronenberg called A Dangerous Method, which is a film about a strange story and a powerful story about a relationship between Jung and Freud and a patient called Sabina, which stars Keira Knightley and Michael Fassbender and Viggo Mortensen.
There's a wonderful thing that the guy who wrote the book and then did the screenplay adaptation, he wrote a piece in the paper in which he said that the screenplay was sent back to him and he read it and it was great, and he sent back to David Cronenberg saying, it's lovely, can you just change two things? David Cronenberg sent back a note, no. Because he's a man who knows what he wants.
I mean, I think Christopher, in fact, you're talking about Christopher Hampton, the great writer.
Yeah. Oh, because he said it on the programme.
Yes, that's right.
Sorry, Simon.
And they're going very well. I think that he was being ironical and joking, but David Cronenberg certainly knows what he wants, and that's why, you know, I want to work with him and work with him a few times, and why Christopher wants to work with him, because, you know, working with a master like Cronenberg, he knows what he wants.
Will there be people at Westminster Council who look at that film and go, oh, we don't want that one either?
Certainly hope so.
I hope so. I mean, that's the reason that I was involved in it.
If you can't annoy the Westminster Council, really, what's the point?
Jeremy, we appreciate you coming in. Thank you very much indeed. Jeremy Thomas being honoured by the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences. Special tribute coming up on the 25th of November. Appreciate you coming in, Jeremy. Thank you very much indeed. We have this from John on the text. The last time I heard your programme, he addresses this to Cy Mark Cameo, I hit a tree and wrote my van off on the way home. I jumped out thinking it was on fire, only to return to find it was the airbag going off, and there were you two on the radio, still talking as if nothing had happened. I now have a four-hour drive home. Wish me luck.
Good luck.
Yeah, he's kind of implicating us in
I thought it was going to be an insurance claim, so...
I don't think it's our fault in any way.
Unless it was me saying snore boo when I was doing paranormal activity.
I don't think so. Bruce in Edmonton, Alberta. I've found the source of the good doctor's fear of pomegranates. Mm-hmm. Here in Canada, 7-Eleven is promoting a new Slurpee flavour, berry pomegranate. The Slurpee's tagline is, he's alive and berry, berry scary. And he sent us a very entertaining, if absolutely hideous face, which is on a pomegranate.
Mm, that's
the photo
good.
I've attached, I assure you, has not been altered in any way. I took it with my phone yesterday. It reminds me of The Hills Have Eyes. Creepy. Tastes good, though, even though it looks like frozen lymph.
That's really weird.
Do you think that might be the source of your fear of pomegranates?
Well, it's certainly not helping.
Anyway, listen, we've spoken to a legendary film producer. Now let's bring in a legendary film editor. That's Thelma Schoonmaker, who's joining us to talk about the legendary Peeping Tom, which is being re-released this week. Hello, Thelma.
Hello.
Joining us from Shepperton Studios, you're very welcome to the programme. Thank you very much indeed for speaking to us. How are you?
I'm fine. I hope there won't be too much noise from forklift trucks moving scenery around behind me.
No, it's okay, Thelma. We've stopped all the forklift trucks down this end. This is Mark in Sydney, Thelma. We met a couple of weeks ago in
yes,
your editing studio.
Absolutely.
What were you doing
I'm
in
right
her
below
editing
it.
Studio?
Yes.
Well, I went there because we were doing a piece for the Culture Show about Peeping Tom. And, of course, Thelma is hard at work cutting Martin Scorsese's 3D film Hugo Cabret. And so we were there to talk about Peeping Tom, which was very nice. It was very exciting for me. So, Thelma, tell us, if you can, about how important it is that Peeping Tom is being re-released. It's the 50th anniversary re-release when the film first came out, directed by Michael Powell, to whom obviously you were married. It was treated horribly by the critics. Why is it important that it's being re-released now?
Because 50 years on, it's now being recognized as, some people call it, a masterpiece. Scorsese certainly does. Forklift truck going by, sorry. So it's wonderful for us to be able to nail that down and make it very evident to people how the reception of the film has changed so markedly.
What we have there is great British special effects, I think, coming to the
yes.
rescue. Before we take this any further, Thelma, can you just tell the story of what's in the film? Because given the fact that it was hidden away for so long, a lot of people won't have seen it. Just tell us what happens in the film, and then we'll get some kind of idea as to why it would have caused people to throw their arms up in horror.
Right. It's about a young man named Mark who is working as a focus puller on a film crew in a big studio like I'm in just now. But he has been tortured as a child by his father, who was doing experiments in fear and used to do things like wake him up in the middle of the night and drop a lizard on him when he was 5 years old to see his reaction and film his reaction. And obviously he's been a bit damaged by this, to say the least. And he has an obsession himself now with trying to record fear on film, and in the duration of the film he kills quite a few people with a strange murder weapon, which is a tripod, the leg of the tripod of his camera, which has a knife in it. And he also has a mirror on it so that he can record the fear on people's faces as they are dying. So it sounds like a really horrible idea, but what the daring of the film was that Carl Broom, who played Mark, and Michael Powell decided to be very daring in their approach and make the character, actually, you feel for him. You feel a great deal of sympathy for him and what he's been through. So this, I think, is what threw the critics when they saw it many years ago. They just couldn't stomach the fact that they were feeling compassion for this man. And they just wrote the most horrifying reviews I think I've ever read about any movie. So I think the fact that it was so unusual, the way they portrayed the murderer in the film, Michael describes him as sweet, attractive, compassionate and quite mad. And this was a very daring thing to do at that time. It's quite perhaps common now, but not at the time. And when you think that Psycho, which came out the same year, was a huge success, but I don't think you feel the same way for Norman Bates in that film. It's a fascinating, beautifully made film, but you don't feel compassion for him, and I think that's what unsettled the critics so terribly.
Do you think that one of the things that upset them also was the fact that the film is about a filmmaker who's obsessed with the process of filming, and it sees filmmaking itself as a dangerous pursuit? There's a line in it about all this filming isn't healthy. It's a film which seems to somehow suggest that actually being interested in cinema, watching cinema, is in itself a somewhat seedy pursuit. Do you think that's possibly what upset some of the critics?
I wouldn't describe it as seedy, but I think it certainly is an obsession. I mean, most filmmakers are intensely devoted to their craft, and they live for it, and their families suffer because of it. So I think filmmaking overall can be very destructive. It's very encompassing and devouring. And I think what Michael Powell was playing with here in this film is how we are all voyeurs in one way, and particularly the critics, let's face it, are voyeurs. That's what they do all day long. They look at movies and write about them. And perhaps that was a little unsettling for them, I think. But it's really about the obsession of art, all arts, really, a painter, a musician, who is desperately trying to get the shot they want or the symphony that they've been dreaming of making. And Michael Powell plays on that in a beautiful way, that Mark just can't get that shot he needs, so he has to go on, unfortunately, killing people. And there's a great deal of satire in the film about a very bad film being made within the film, and Michael Powell was able to poke a lot of jokes at his own world. And there are many, many in-jokes in it, which filmmakers love.
We were talking to Jeremy Thomas just a few moments ago, and one of the films that came up was Crash, David Cronenberg film. And sometimes when a film becomes controversial, it is entirely fabricated. It's just got up by a couple of film critics. But was there something about this film that Michael Powell knew was going to put the cat amongst the pigeons?
I don't think he knew that. They were having so much fun making it. And Anna Massey the other night, the other star in the film, who plays the woman who is drawn to Mark and he to her, kept talking about how intensely they were all working. They were having a fantastic time and felt very devoted to the film. I don't think they expected the bad reaction. Michael Powell himself, having seen a lot of great directors before him have their careers ruined by going too far, which is not what we feel as filmmakers, that you go too far, but other people did, studios did. I think he was able, when this terrible crisis occurred and the film was yanked from distribution, he was able to somehow digest it perhaps a little better than Carl Boehm, who played the part of Mark, who to this day just does not understand what happened. And it was very painful for all of them. I don't think they thought they would get this reaction. I think they thought people would understand what they were doing.
But Thelma, considering the difficulties that the film created for Michael Powell making movies afterwards, and considering how fast it disappeared from distribution, I mean, you knew him better than most. You were married to him. Was he bitter about it? Was he just reconciled to the awful reception that it got?
He was never bitter in all of his life, which I think is one of the triumphs of his life, because he suffered so horribly in the last 20 years of his life, not being able to make films, which were his lifeblood. It would be as if Scorsese had that happen to him. It's just unimaginable to think of. But he never became bitter. He always kept on dreaming and writing films and helping younger filmmakers. He never lost his passion for this art that he had devoted himself to. He was very angry at the distributor, because he said if they had only taken out an ad with some of these terrible reviews which said things like, this should be flushed down the toilet, if they had taken out an ad with some of those reviews and then said at the bottom of it, this is what the critic said, why don't you come see for yourself, he thought that it would have had a very good chance. But that's the kind of thing he would do, and unfortunately the producer did not agree. Michael called him a man with a tiny mind, and he withdrew the film, and it wasn't seen for a very, very long time.
And then, obviously, it was reintroduced to the public with this, you know, screening at the New York Film Festival. It was redistributed. Scorsese has championed it and has, you know, gone around telling everyone what an important film it was. Just recently, he was at BAFTA introducing a screening of it. Do you think that, as far as Michael Powell was concerned, seeing it reborn like that was significant?
Oh, yes. I think Scorsese and the British Film Institute had so much to do with bringing the whole work of Michael Powell and his great partner, Emeric Pressburger, together. They made some fantastic masterpieces during the war and after. The Red Shoes is one of them. And A Matter of Life and Death, Canterbury Tale, I Know Where I'm Going, A Life and Death of Colonel Blimp, all these wonderful films. These were all brought back by Scorsese and the British Film Institute to the world, and they are now still playing as if almost new. It's quite remarkable. Unfortunately, Michael got to see that. I was with him and saw him stand before an audience of 18-year-olds in the state of Ohio at a university and see them all reacting intensely to a film he had made in 1944. And it was wonderful to see. So he was very lucky that he, through the work of Marty and the BFI, that he was able to see it come back. He was very, very lucky. I think he was a little surprised at the way Peeping Tom was latched onto by people at the New York Film Festival, people like Steven Soderbergh and Francis Coppola, who saw it there and were knocked out by it. And he was a little surprised at how enthusiastic everybody was after all these years, I think. Not about the great masterpieces, but about this film. I think he thought it was amusing and lovely.
Thelma, what are you at liberty to tell us about the new Martin Scorsese film?
Oh, not much, but
tell us.
Okay, we know it's Hugo Cabret. It's in 3D. It's a live action adaptation of Brian Selznick's award winning young person's novel.
I asked her, not you.
No. But I'm saying that's how much we can say. Beyond that, Thelma, what can you tell us?
I can't really. I'm sorry, but it's just so beautiful. Where Scorsese has always had a deep love of 3D. And the first thing he did when we started working on this film was screen the old 3D masterpieces that he loved so much. A House of Wax and Dial M for Murder is absolutely wonderful in 3D. Most people have never seen it that way. And we just loved them. I mean, we were just eating them up. He had me and the director of photography and our visual effects people, and we had a great time. And so he's really being very extreme in his use of 3D, and so much so that sometimes when we're watching the dailies, we gasp ourselves at what it looks like on the big screen.
And this isn't retrofitted 3D. You're shooting live action 3D, proper 3D.
Absolutely, which is quite arduous, you know, because these 3D rigs, some of them don't have zoom lenses, and so every time you change the framing of a shot, it takes 20 minutes to change the lenses and line up the two cameras and make sure the mirror is right, and so it's quite slow. But worth it, I'll tell you. I mean,
well, can I just ask you on that, Thelma, because I just wonder, just finally from me, there are some people like Mark. Who are so, you know, just irreconcilable with the whole concept. The mention of 3D is like red rag to a bull, and he gets very, very dull and very boring when he goes off on one about it. Might this be the kind of film that wins over boring sceptics like Mark, who just like to go on and on about how it's the end of the world and we're all going to die?
I hope so. I really do think it will. For judging by the people who've seen some things, I really feel it will. People say they feel within it and they don't want to leave it, so that would be after watching 35 minutes of it, so I hope that's a good sign.
But tell me this, though, as I mean, I have a terrible skepticism, but I've seen a lot of 3D films recently. I have to say I haven't been won over by them. Were you skeptical about 3D at all before? Has this film changed your mind about 3D at all, or were you always open-minded to it?
No, I had seen with Scorsese some years ago, you know, proper 3D films like House of Wax projected properly with two prints and two projectors, and I must say I enjoyed it immensely. I've not enjoyed as much the more modern versions of 3D that I've seen, I have to admit, but after working on this, I do feel very differently about it.
Thelma, we appreciate you speaking to us. Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Thelma Schoonmaker. And is that, that's a Blu-ray, I think. It's coming out on Blu-ray, isn't it, this particular version of
Peeping Tom? Well, it's in cinemas, and then it will be available on Blu-ray as well.
So what's going to happen now is you're going to have a box office top 10, which we'll do till 3 o'clock, and then after 3 we will be publishing and broadcasting, indeed performing, the new Wittertainment Code of Cinematic Conduct, to which you were all expected to adhere.
May I just say very quickly, Thelma Schoonmaker, legendary editor, but isn't she just incredibly nice? When you look at the extraordinary body of work and the rest of it, just the most incredibly nice person. Sorry, I just wanted to say that.
Exactly right. And for the first time when you said, can I just say quickly, you actually were
quick. I actually was, yeah.
Which is extraordinary. OK, box office top 10. If we've got time before 3 o'clock, I want to go back to some of the films that have dropped out of the top 10. But for the moment, at 10 is Another Year.
Which is, for my mind...
What's Another Year?
It's... Oh, who did that? What's
Johnny Logan.
Johnny Logan, beat button. It's, you know,
are
I think.
You impressed with that?
I am. I was just trying to. Sing me a bit of it. Go on.
Why? Why would
because,
that
Because it does go, what's another. Oh, that's What's It All About?
No, that's
Mike Lee. There we go. That's what Another
it's
Year
completely
is.
Completely different song.
Okay, fine. I think it's Mike Lee back on form. It's a film that takes part over four seasons, hence Another Year. It's about a central couple, Tom and Jerry, who are very good people, and their friends who are having much more trouble connecting with the world. I mean, I think it's one of Mike Lee's best works. I liked it very much. I suspected that it would win the Cannes Palme d'Or. Of course, at that point, I hadn't seen Uncle Boon Me, Who Can Remember His Past Lives, which, as always with these things, was shown the day that I left Cannes, and actually went on to win, and we'll be reviewing that later on. But it's a very, very fine Mike Lee.
Alpha and Omega at 9, or indeed Omega, as some people have it.
Yeah, that's a very forgettable animation about... class-breaking wolves. It's, you know, wolves from one class to another class, and it says, hey...
Do they have upper and middle class and working class?
They have
wolves.
Alpha and Omega wolves.
Well, is it just two classes?
Yeah.
Just upper and middle, or middle and lower, or what? What is
yeah,
it?
They, actually, they didn't really go into the middle class dynamic, but because that's
they skip the middle class, they just have upper and working.
Yeah, exactly. Upper and working class.
They're the only ones. So there's the Julian Fellows.
Yes.
And there's the Ken Loaches.
Yeah.
Is that how it goes?
That's pretty much it.
Paranormal Activity 2.
Paranormal Activity 2.
Carl McManus, who went to see your presentation, as he calls it, in Chester.
Are you coming tonight to North
Finchley? You asked me at the beginning of the show.
I know, but are you going to come?
I don't know, then. I'm not.
Oh, okay. Come on.
During your book signing, you were good enough to... We were talking about Paranormal Activity. I said, I'm going to go and see it. You told me to email the show with my opinion.
All right.
So here I am. I thought the film was interesting, worked well as a sequel. It did a great job of continuing the original's low-key style.
I jumped
a few times, but found it lacked the original sense of creeping, escalating dread. It's nice to have a modern horror film which uses subtle scares rather than full-on gore and brutality.
That's thank you for that. I wish I hadn't asked.
You asked him to email in.
And he did.
And he disagreed with you. How splendid.
That's fine. And it's very well expressed.
The Social Network at 7.
Is it misogynist or is it about misogyny? The debate continues to rage. The more I think about it, the more substantial I think it is. I liked it first time round, but it has stayed with me. And I do think it's quite an achievement to have made a film about people that obnoxious, doing something that fundamentally obnoxious. And make it interesting. And I like the fact that it's got a very, very misanthropic view of the world. And I like it.
Is that because you too have a misanthropic view of the world?
Well, you too are one of the world's most boring rock bands. They can be as misanthropic as they like.
Don't dodge the question. Do you also...
This is like the Mike Lee question. Mike Lee said, do you not like Happy Go Lucky because basically you're a miserable git?
And the answer to that is...
Of course that's the case.
Red is at 6.
Which I didn't think was anything like as bad as some other critics have seemed to think. I mean, it's not a great work by any means, but it's, you know, it's kind of funny and sardonic in some ways. It's got quite jolly little action sequences. It's got Helen Mirren in a ball gown and toting a machine gun, which is... I mean, it is no great shakes, but the fact that it's hung in for as long as it has proves that, it is at least working for some people. I didn't hate it by any means. It was perfectly all right.
Saw 3D, is it? 5.
Which I did hate. I did hate. I mean, the Saw movies I find extraordinarily depressing. You know, in a week in which Peeping Tom is being reissued, you know, you look at what real, genuine, horrifying cinema can do. You look at the... I noticed, certainly from the BBFC, that it's been downgraded from 18 to 15, a Peeping Tom. And yet the ideas in it are, you know, definitely 18-rated ideas. Saw.
It's got X on the poster. Of
yeah, I know, which is great. Don't you long
more
for the
evocative.
Days of the X? It really is. Peeping Tom X. But in the case of Saw, it's just garbage. It's infantile, trashy garbage, and it's everything that's wrong.
There should be a G certificate, then.
Which is what?
Garbage.
Grot. There was a G certificate in the past, which was general audience. That was for America.
That might be a little bit misleading then, if applied
to
the Saw 3D.
Yeah, you have to come up with a new letter.
Jackass 3D, is it for?
It's what 3D was invented for. I mean, it's just odd to be having this conversation immediately, having talked to Thelma Schoonmaker about, you know, whether or not Martin Scorsese is, you know, reinventing 3D, because the whole Jackass 3D thing is, it's what 3D was made for. Now, here's the thing with Jackass. First 20 minutes of it, which is jokes about them all hitting each other in the face with great big polystyrene hands, I laughed, and I laughed a lot. I confess, I laughed a lot. After that, it then descends into the bodily, and somebody sent it, wrote in to correct us about this. It's not bodily excretions, it's bodily secretions.
Well, good. I'm glad that was pointed out. That's a really, really important difference.
Well, for a pedant like me, it is important, but there's much too much going to the toilet and vomiting after that, and I didn't find that funny. And it is like,
it not as funny as Mr. Poopy Goes to the Toilet?
No, it's not. I mean, Mr. Okay. Poopy Goes to the Toilet, it's just, but it's, you know, the actual sight of you know, overgrown teenage boys, and they're not teenagers, obviously, throwing up is not funny.
Right, Despicable Me in one sentence.
Not very interesting, but probably better if you don't sit next to a woman eating her sofa.
Exactly. Skyline at 2, this from Ollie in London. Avoid Skyline like the plague, one of the worst movies I've ever seen. Honestly, basically a long visual effects showreel strung together with a non-story and laugh-out-loud cliched dialogue. Could any of the Z-list actors really take it so seriously? The audience in my screening were at first silent and respectful, then restless and bored. Finally, they were howling with laughter at the screen. The worst part, that Dr. K could even bring himself to be even slightly eloquent about Skyline in his review. First, he shamed me into thinking that I shouldn't have really enjoyed Let Me In. Then he talked with disdain, but not enough, about Skyline. I thought it might actually be watchable trash. It was unwatchable trash.
Well, I've had a lot of this. I mean, a lot of stuff on Twitter, people saying, how dare you? You've completely let me down. The fact that you recommended... I didn't recommend it. What I said was, it's not as terrible as everyone thinks. And the fact is that for $15 million, they've had some, you know, they've done some special effects work you wouldn't expect for that. But honestly, the tirade of people saying, you just should have trampled all over this. Me and Kim Newman had pretty much the same response, which was, you know... Kim Newman, he writes for Empire, Sight and Sound, many places. He's been on the BBC. He's regular voice. Okay. You know, both he and I thought the same thing about it. It's not terrible.
Leo says it's a pathetic heap of garbage. You owe me 2 hours of my life.
Apparently so. And apparently it's my fault.
Yes.
Apparently in actually
Due date
not
is at number
saying,
one.
Which is better than The Hangover. Robert Downey Jr. is quite funny, but it's not as funny as it ought to be. But there were some laughs in it.
In this hour, you'll get reviews of all the weekend's new releases. Primarily, of course, Harry Potter and the Deathly Hallows Part 1. If you're wondering what the kind of the wobble ball...
Yeah, can I point out that we have created on the noisiest code of...
That's our code of conduct. That's how it comes out the printer.
Yeah. Well, all I can say is you can't... One of the things we should have added in, don't take a wobbly code of conduct into the cinema.
Well, I put on Twitter...
Sun arise early in the morning.
Thanks. That now at last you've got something to flourish at miscreants in the cinema... to which someone said, well, in which case can you add no flourishing of pieces of paper? So the code of conduct has been compiled over the last few weeks. Thank you for your patience. Because so many people were saying, you know, this really annoys me when I go to the cinema. This really annoys me. But actually, on balance, this is the thing that annoys me the most. So we've assembled them. We have compiled them. We have complied them. They've gone through every single rigorous test, and we've sort of boiled it down into the Ten Commandments of cinema attendance, which is why it might be appropriate if we perform it with this music. Prepare the tablets of stone. Pass the chisel. Ten Commandments music.
It is. Moses comes down from the mountain. He says, the good news is, they're down to 10. Adultery is... No, never mind.
Now, the entertainment code of conduct. Take it away, Dr. Mark.
No eating of anything harder than a soft roll with no filling. No one wants to hear you crunch, chew or masticate in any way. Nachos cause special offence and are of the devil.
No slurping of drinks. You've already drunk a 5-litre flagon of pop. You really don't need the melting ice too. You are not 6 years old.
No rustling of super high-density, rustle-o-matic, extra-rustle bags. No foraging of any kind. If you're going to need it during the film, get it out beforehand.
No irresponsible parenting. Your five-year-old does not want to come to see the latest 12A certificate. You are using the cinema as a babysitter. Your child's moaning, whinging and crying is your fault and a profound annoyance to everyone else. Your interrupted sleep caused by your child's nightmares are also your fault and serves you right.
Good grammatic correction whilst reading out.
Thank you, you noticed that.
No hobbies. This includes knitting, drug dealing, model aeroplane assembly, fighting, having sex, and updating Facebook.
You've been to my cinema. No talking. You're in a cinema. You have come here to watch, not to discuss, or engage, or participate, or explain, or whatever. More importantly, no one in the cinema has paid £8.50 to hear your director's commentary on the movie. Just sit down and shut up.
No mobile phone usage at all. Not even on flight mode. This isn't an aeroplane, it's a cinema. Even if you're not yapping, you're still creating light pollution. Put your thumbs away. NB includes BlackBerries, Palm Pilots, iPads, whatever.
No kicking of seats. The area of floor directly in front of your seat is yours and is there to put your legs in. The back of the seat in front of you belongs to someone else. Do not touch, interfere with, or otherwise invade their space with your feet, knees, or other bodily appendages.
No arriving late. Like Woody Allen in Annie Hall, you're supposed to watch movies from the very beginning to the very end. If you turn up late, tough. Go see something else. The Sorrow and the Pity, perhaps.
And finally, no shoe removal. That's no shoe removal. You are not in your own front room. Nor are you in Japan. Unless you are, in which case, carry on. A cinema is a public space. Keep your bodily odours to yourself.
There endeth
the first lesson of the Wittertainment Code of Conduct. Do you think we come over as slightly
pompous,
overbearing,
yes,
and grumpy?
I certainly hope so.
Do you think?
We've been working for 10 years towards that. Did you know that we are approaching our 10th anniversary, Simon?
I'm looking forward to the celebrations.
Yeah.
What would be great is if we... Why don't we tie it into, I don't know, let's say a date in spring next year? And then if we could have... What we should do is,
yeah,
that if there was a royal wedding at the same time, we could kind of like piggyback on the top.
Is there one?
Apparently there is.
Do we know when it is?
That would be good. Sort of spring. We could see if we could book Westminster Abbey.
to launch. The acoustics in there are terrible.
10 years away. And the Dodge Brothers,
yeah,
could be there.
Could play Westminster. Well, we played the Albert Hall. Westminster Abbey surely awaits. So, now, Simon, what can people do to... Thunderize.
Well, they can't get one of the... I don't think you... I mean, Ian Wheeler in Surbiton said, can I register a complaint? Not only does your charter not come ready laminated, as per your repeated assertions, it doesn't even come out in colour on my black and white printer. Says he, fancy that, eh? So I will apologise for that.
So if people want this, Simon, what can they do? And I'm asking you, not rhetorically, I'm genuinely asking.
Well,
I don't know. No,
well,
they can
come round to your house and you can handwrite a copy and pass it to them. Or you could go to the website, bbc.co.uk/5live. And I think it's there. I mean, right on the front page, it's all blatantly obvious and you can go there. The code of conduct is there. Feel free. It is yours. And as we make it very clear, it has been... I mean, we sort of cobbled it together in the end, but it was put together by you lot, so thank you very much indeed for your contributions. It's your priorities that we put out there.
It does say at the bottom, many thanks to all witcherers out there who have contributed to our code. I wonder whether at some point we're going to produce an appendage document with all the things that we couldn't get in, the very specific ones, like, for example, my favourite, which was no waving of lightsabers,
yes,
in screening, which had particularly spoiled somebody's screening, but it was so specific that we couldn't do it in the top 10.
Well, there are lots, and it will continue. I mean, I think we've done it as far as the programme is concerned, but as it's just been performed, Tom in Scarborough wanted us to put in no armed guards. He was watching Gangs of New York at his local urban cinema and he got interrupted by armed police looking for two chaps sitting on the back row. But I think that's probably covered by no hobbies, including drug dealing, because I suspect that's what was going on there.
Actually, I'm not going to have no armed guards because there was, and this is quite serious, back in the 1980s, early 90s, when the American cinema chains decided that they were going to attempt to get a handle on people misbehaving in cinemas, did actually introduced...
Arm the ushers.
Yeah, arm the ushers. They introduced guards, I mean bodyguards, proper bodyguards in cinemas, who wouldn't just say, excuse me, would you mind not doing that, but would headlock you out of the door. And, of course, having been thrown out of the Cannes Film Festival, which is... I mean, the ushers in the Cannes Film Festival are really built. I mean, they are proper ushers. They're not there to ush you. They are there to physically remove you should you not be behaving properly.
Well, if the ushers had weapons... Then this, we wouldn't need the
tasers. Not weapons, tasers.
Oh, okay.
Although a taser is technically a weapon.
On the front page of the 5Live website, all the information is there for the code of conduct, and there's a link that you click and you can get the poster.
Okay.
Everything is explained. Lucy Sky in Reading. Could you make your code of conduct into a tea towel, like the retro swimming pool one that you can buy? I can then wave it in people's faces at the cinema when they're offending. But I'm not sure that's going to be very tough.
I think a towel's a good idea, because I was reading my son Hitchhiker's Guide recently, and I'd forgotten the whole thing about the definition of somebody who's really cool is a fruit who knows where his towel is.
No, that's true, and they actually did make some very nice towels, didn't they?
I'm sure they did, yeah. Well, actually, well, shall we try and do that, the Code of Conduct towel?
Can I just ask, because someone asked me a very, very pertinent question about the Code of Conduct.
Yeah.
The worst film I have ever been to see was the first Pokemon film. Okay.
Oh, right.
Which was just
pocket money.
Truly
horrible.
Awful.
Yeah, horrible.
And terrible. Now, if you're in a cinema full of kids, it being a kid's film and all,
yes.
Are you not entitled to yes. eat noisy sweets yeah. and maybe even text your wife saying, this is the worst film I've seen, because of the general level of bedlam?
Are you trying to
created?
Retrospectively get some kind of pardon?
Well, I'm just saying, you know, is this for
well,
senior?
John of this parish, who I was speaking to outside.
Who?
John.
Who's John?
John, who used to run the show.
Oh, him. Sorry, we're on air, I forgot. This sounded as though we were in the pub or something, but everyone else listening is going...
Well, unlike
the
whole
John?
Of the rest of the show doesn't know, but that's what I find. Obviously, we're outside and we're just
talking about John Kerry, the editor of Drive Time.
Yes.
Yes, okay.
John.
Yes. I'm speaking... I have a Corrick role. I'm speaking on behalf of the audience.
Yeah, Corrick is one word for it. Said outside,
what about John?
He was saying that he had taken a child to the Saturday morning screening, which was 95p apparently for Saturday morning screenings in certain cinema chains, apparently. And he said, fantastic, good value. He went to see Diary of a Wimpy Kid, but said, my assumption is that if you're in a 95p Saturday morning kid screening, all rules are off, because the children that he had gone with had broken all 10 rules in about the first...
You I can mean, kick seats,
only,
you can
only
rustle,
not
slurp,
being connected
eat.
To the internet prevented them breaking the last one. So that is definitely a proviso, isn't it? If you go to a kids' matinee screening, all bets are off.
Chris Ratcliffe emails to say, dear Crash Override and Acid Burn, having
very
skipped
good.
Through half of the Jason Isaacs interview, which was Jason was on last week's programme, as it became clear details about the film were being revealed, I heard the phrase... Well, everyone knows what happens. We're not talking about Spartans, sledges or cruise liners with iceberg fixations. This is only a few years since the book came out. I've queued for two Harry Potter books with my girlfriend, but bought neither. I've never even read one. However, thanks to said lovely girlfriend, I have watched and enjoyed all the films to date. I'm looking forward to the next Harry Potter films as a fan of the films, and I come to them completely cold. Please keep me and others like me, I'm guessing there are at least a few of us, in mind when we're entertaining. And he adds... An interesting PS, with Mark's high watermark for tech film Hackers now coming up to 15 years old. Good grief, is that true?
Amazing.
With its references to payphones, modems and stolen tech manuals, does it now class as a period drama?
It does.
Which is an interesting thought.
It's really funny. We showed that at the Llama Tree Festival, and I programmed a film strand, and it was amazing seeing it again, just how the idea that they have to go to payphones and they have to put money into the thing. And there was... You know, younger people in the audience literally going, what are they doing?
I think it was written by Lord Fellows, wasn't it?
It was, yes.
It was one of his first. So we take that in mind, Chris Ratcliffe. Thank you very much. We understand that most people probably do know the story, but a lot of people only go see the films, they don't read the books. So take it away.
Harry Potter and the Deathly Hallows Part 1, which is obviously the first half of the last book of Harry Potter. I think one of the things we talked about before was to say that it's not a film that does a lot of Basil exposition. It's not a film that attempts to say previously on Harry Potter. The fact of the matter is they're at the seventh part now. There's a general assumption that if you've got this far, you're kind of...
up to speed. With it.
Yes, and I think that there's really no way of getting around that. If you're considering going to see Harry Potter and the Deathly Hallows Part 1 and you haven't seen any of the Harry Potter films
you
before...
You won't have a clue.
You won't have a clue. And more importantly, it's kind of like you're going to have to watch at least... Well, I mean, I would... Are there any? Are there any? I mean, you don't need to worry with the first two because that's just the Chris Columbus ones. But if you start with Prisoner of Azkaban and go on from there, well, that will pretty much get you up to speed. Actually, no, I don't know what I'm saying because the first. I always do that. You see, I say the first two aren't
the. What I'm saying.
No, the first two. But actually, Jason's biggest part is the Dobby, which is part two, and of course he is brilliant in that part. So start from the beginning. There's no point in seeing part seven if you haven't seen the other parts.
You've got a lot of prep to do.
Yeah, but they're all available on a box set. There's a Blu-ray box set that just came out recently with all the previous parts, so you have to do that. And I quite like the fact that, for example, when we get to a conversation about Godric's Hollow, nobody says, what's that then? Nobody stops and says, oh, this is what... Did you just say Godric's Hollow? Really fine. OK, keep up. So what we can tell you is the story is essentially that the three main characters, Harry, Ron and Hermione, are on the run. At the beginning of the movie, we see them going on the run, and then for a great portion of the movie, they are on the run. They are out of Hogwarts, which is in many ways the film's major innovation, that they are out in the wilderness, in the forest, and although key big special effects set pieces and battles do happen, a great portion of the movie actually takes place with them as the three central characters in some kind of isolation. We have a couple of clips. Let's play whichever one happens to be to hand.
Do you bring news, I trust?
It will happen Saturday next at nightfall.
I've heard differently, my lord. Dolish Theora has let slip that the Potter boy will not be moved until the 30th of this month, the day before he turns 17.
This is a false trail. The Aura office no longer plays any part in the protection of Harry Potter. Those closest to him believe we have infiltrated the Ministry.
Well, they got that right then, didn't they?
What say you, Pius?
One hears many things, my lord. Whether the truth is among them is not clear.
Spoken like a true politician. You will, I think, prove most useful, Pius. Where will he be taken, the boy?
To a safe house. Most likely the home of someone in the Order. I'm told it's been given every manner of protection possible. Once there, it will be impractical to attack him.
My lord, I'd like to volunteer myself for this task. I want to kill the boy.
Wormtail! Have I not spoken to you about keeping our guest quiet?
Yes, my lord. Right away, my lord.
As inspiring as I find your bloodlust, Bellatrix, I must be the one to kill Harry Potter.
You just heard every single available British actor.
Yeah, you did.
What a roll call that was.
But also,
fantastic stuff.
That's probably, of all the bits in the film, the thing that gets closest to an explanation of what's going on. I mean, that kind of does set it up, that Voldemort has to kill him, that Snape has now gone over to the dark side. That...
Was there a creak? A creaky floor?
That Snape has now gone over to the dark side.
What do we know of Dumbledore?
Can we say it now?
Well, that's the thing. I don't know.
Oh, blimey, Charlie. Unfortunate incident has happened. Consequently, Dumbledore...
Boy, is it unfortunate.
Consequently, Dumbledore does not feature as strongly in this film as perhaps he has done in some previous parts, OK? So,
but may well be returning in the next part.
Maybe. Who knows?
Who knows?
Who knows? Well, those who've read the book happen to know. OK. So here's the important stuff. Firstly, there are set pieces in the movie which are every bit as good as the best set pieces in Harry Potter. I think that going into the Ministry set pieces works really, really well. They take Polyjuice Potion, they transform into other people. There is some very, very funny moments in which actors have to pretend to be other actors, which kind of reminded me of Face Off, you know, when Nick Cage and John Travolta have to take on each other's mannerisms, and that works rather well. There are some special effects scenes which you can see when they were attempting to do the retro fitted 3D, they probably spent an awful lot of time doing them. There's one very scary moment with a snake, which I imagine when they were 3D-izing it, they spent a lot of time trying to do that. I am thrilled that this release is a 2D release and that what they decided in the end was to let the movie be seen as it was shot. We are still going to have a retrofitted 3D release, apparently. The question of whether or not part two will come out in 3D first is as yet unsolved, but my own preference would be that we see it as as it was meant to be shot, because for me, the most important thing about the film is it has a very bleak, very dark, very portentous, very, I mean, you know, even potentially Bergman-esque look about it. It is a film of...
How would I know a Bergman-esque film if I see
Well,
one?
You know, Seventh Seal. It's a film of death and shadows. It is, I mean, as the title suggests, The Deathly Hallows, although obviously the explanation of exactly what The Deathly Hallows are comes fairly late in the day. It is a it is a movie about dark things happening. The plot, such as it is essentially the core group must fall apart in order to pull back together again to face the final battle. Now, the final battle is coming up in the next part, and one of the reservations that you expressed before was that without the final battle, there's an awful lot of doom and gloom and despondency and despair, and we end at what you thought perhaps wasn't an entirely satisfactory moment. Myself, I thought that the moment that they had chosen as the breaking point was very good, because it ends much as a previous film had ended with the death of a significant character. This ends with the death of a significant character, a character who has become significant late on in the course of the story.
Who's that then?
Snape, all right? Snape stiffs it.
That's a joke.
Okay, it's a joke. He doesn't. Or maybe
he might
does.
Do.
Maybe he does. Who knows, okay?
Maybe it wasn't a joke.
Yeah, maybe it wasn't. Maybe he hasn't gone to the dark. Who knows whether he has? So I really like the way the film looks. I like the cinematography of it. I like the way it's directed. I like the aesthetic of it. And for me, that was a great part of what I enjoyed about it, was looking at a film that had this sense of, you know, of ominous, of doom, of portent, of darkness, of gathering clouds. The idea that throughout the whole course of the movie, the storm clouds of war are gathering, and you know that you're not going to get to the great big final battle, but you can see them coming. And now, I liked that very much. If I have any reservations at all, it is that the film does take its time, although I don't have a problem with it doing that, but some people might not be quite as patient. I think maybe some parts of the younger audience will find some of it slightly lacking in, you know, in action-packed thrills. It's not... I mean, if you look back, it's amazing. If you look back at the first two movies now, which were essentially fairground rides with beaming happy children running around and, you know, talking portraits and jollity and all that sort of stuff, which for me was never the point anyway. As you know, the point which
apart
I got...
Apart from Ian Hart's demonically possessed head.
Yes, actually, which was very creepy, wasn't it? And then that is Ian Hart, and that was... So he did a brilliant job with that. But for me, what I like about it is... It, more than any of the stories so far, it's about the central relationship. It takes the other stuff away. I mean, you've got Snape and Voldemort and all the forces gathering, but it's essentially about those three characters, about the fact that Ron is falling in love with Hermione and is worried about Hermione's relationship with Harry. The fact that Harry and Ron are no longer the young boys that they used to be, but have now grown up into people who've become sort of, you know, turned by that sort of adolescent angst, that they are people whose brains are filled with, you know, thoughts of doom and destruction and despondency. The fact
and,
that Hermione...
And lust, maybe.
Well, and lust. Do you turn into a priest? And lust, maybe. Maybe. And in fact, there is one, I refer you to this in the BBFC...
Lustful moments, I noticed.
Yes, there are. The BBFC, which rates it 12A for moderate fancy violence and threat, says the film possesses a fairly dark and intense tone in common with many of the more recent installments of Harry Potter. And then it does say other issues include an unusual sequence in which we see a vision conjured by Voldemort in order to taunt Ron of an apparently naked Harry and Hermione embracing. And so it's all the way through it, all those things that were, you know, underneath were important to the character developments. That actually the thing about Ron is that he's Harry's best friend, but does that make him jealous? Does it make him a second in command? Does it make him a sidekick? The fact that Hermione, more than ever, that sort of bookishness that she has about her character kind of comes into its own because she's the one who keeps a clear his head. And I, you know, you do get a sense of Harry on his own, in a state of, you know, semi-isolation, facing up to what clearly is the end of it. Because, as you know, for ages and ages, when the books were being found out, everyone was saying the only way this can possibly resolve itself is that Harry has to offer the final sacrifice. So I the more I think about it, the more I think it's really good.
Shall we? Let's hear another clip featuring the three kids.
Okay.
Oh, my God.
What?
I'll tell you in a minute.
Maybe you could tell me now.
Sword of Gryffindor. It's goblin made.
Brilliant.
No, you don't understand. Dirt and rust have no effect on the blade. It only takes in that which makes it stronger.
Okay.
Harry, you already destroyed one Horcrux, right? Tom Riddle's diary in the Chamber of Secrets.
With a basilisk fang? If you tell me you've got one of those in that bloody beaded bag of yours.
Don't you see? In the Chamber of Secrets, you stab the basilisk with a sword of Gryffindor. Its blade is impregnated with basilisk venom.
It only takes in that which makes it stronger.
Exactly, which is why...
It can destroy Horcruxes.
That's why Dumbledore left it to you in his will.
You are brilliant, Hermione. Truly.
Actually, I'm highly logical, which allows me to look past extraneous detail and perceive clearly that which others overlook.
Yeah.
The film also, read
out as many of those as you think is appropriate. That made me laugh.
From the British Board of Film Classification.
God bless them.
The film also features occasional mild and discreet sex references. There are also several uses of mild bad language. I think we heard one there slipped through. Specifically, hell, damn, git, and arse. There's a couple that I missed out there. But Harry cusses, as I think you hear in there. I think my personal preference would have been for a 3-hour go for it and finish.
Really? I disagree with you.
Because they spend so long bitented going through angst and turmoil, which I think you could probably have lost. And so what happens is the film, when it finishes, I think, and as Jason accepted, actually, when he was, you go, oh, it stopped.
But I didn't.
Well, that's because you're weird.
Isn't it interesting that when this whole thing started, your position and mine was completely reversed? You were so excited about the first Harry Potter movie.
I know what you're saying, and you were very much Lord of the Rings. Yeah. Exactly. I think cinematically, all the Harry Potter films don't hold a candle to Lord of the Rings. However, I think each new Harry Potter film is fantastically exciting because they've been such an important... The books and them, all of them together, have been such an important part of the family growing up. So that's why I think they're all fantastically exciting.
I say the thing... I think one of the reasons I feel maybe more particularly charitable towards it is I do feel that having grown into the Potter story, that actually, as it's gone on, it hasn't let me down more. It's like it's picked up the pace, it's got darker, it's got deeper, it's got, you know, I mean, all the stuff that I really didn't like about the first two films has gone more and more into abeyance. And even when it stumbles and trips, as occasionally, I think, which is what you're saying there, that maybe there are longueurs and maybe it doesn't end properly, I think that the intentions are bang on.
A couple of comments, then some news and sport. We'll continue till 4 o'clock. This from Ruben. Says, I recently saw Harry Potter and Deathly Hallows. I am 13-year-old boy. I had high expectations for this film, as I liked the previous films. My expectations were not reached. The film seemed to be like a teenage boy's bedroom, all messy and he is one.
He is one.
All messy and just not a very nice experience. I struggled to find out the central plot for this film and found Harry incredibly annoying. He does nothing, and when Harry is in trouble, another character gets him out of a hole. Boring and dull. So in summary, I dislike this film. Please tell Mark to answer my question tonight at the Arts Depot.
What was the name?
Ruben Block.
Well, you'll be there, obviously, at the Arts Depot in North Finchley to prompt him. But can I just say, did he say he's 13?
He's 13.
That analogy of it's like being in a teenage boy's bedroom is brilliant. That kid has got a career ahead of him as a good film critic.
Andy in The Hague, currently living in the Netherlands. I was able to get to an opening showing of Harry Potter and the Deathly Hallows Part 1 at midnight on Tuesday, as the film opened 3 days earlier out here than in the UK. In many ways, I do believe this is the best Potter film to date, but I felt that the film was caught between a rock and a hard place. While the action set pieces were the most impressive in any Potter film I have seen so far, and the fact that the entire film takes place out of Hogwarts gives it a fresh feel and a bleak tone that reminded me of Children of Men somewhat.
I can see a little bit of that, yes.
In my opinion, it suffered because it chose to be too faithful to the book. The decision to split was justified, I believe, but at the same time, you ended up feeling like you've only seen half the story, a story that, much like in the book, goes through extreme peaks and troughs of high-octane action and sitting around in a tent. I thought the film's uneven pace took away from what was otherwise a highly engaging 146 minutes of my time. Five Live, we broadcast our new code of conduct. It is available in a poster. You go to the front page of the Five Live website, and you click the link from there and you can download it. On some facts arising from that. Phil says, I once purposely kicked the chair of the patron in front of me because he kept looking at his phone and was annoying me. Is this acceptable? I don't think it is.
That's like two wrongs making a right.
Yeah. Well, it's not acceptable.
No. I think the thing to do is to lean over and explain to him that you heard on Radio 5 that you weren't allowed to do that.
Tristan says...
See how that goes down.
Fantastic list. A note about number 10. I do live in Japan. And number 10, by the way, no shoe removal. You're not in your own front room, nor are you in Japan unless you are.
In which case, carry on. We very specifically put in unless you're, because we do recognise that we have an oddly loyal following in Japan.
I do live in Japan, says Tristan. I do take my shoes off in the cinema, but I think I may be the only one.
Sure, but that's perfectly fine. That's,
carry on.
Yeah, we do. Carry on.
What do we have here? Rachel in Harrogate, I'm thinking of using your code of conduct as the new classroom rules for my 11-year-olds. So you feel free to extend it to any workplace situation. And I think Chris from Masham might have the answer to the guy who wanted to kick the chair. Will the 10 code of conducts, or codes of conduct, be available in postcard size so I can gently tap an offender on the shoulder and pass them a card? Now, that seems to me, you can't flap a tea towel, you can't wave a wobbly laminate at them, but if you had a small card, you could just tap them on the shoulder, hand them a card, then they could read it on the journey home and realise the error of their ways.
I used to have small laminated cards printed out that said, congratulations, you are the 109th person today to have made that. That's a big violin. How'd you get that under your chin? Best you bet you wish you'd played the harmonica. Gag.
Hilarious. Mm. Gerard says, I was distressed to learn that you neglected to include a rule which discourages those who laugh in a superfluously loud
way.
Yeah,
we were very specific about that. Funnily enough, that was cause for some discussion. And in the end, we decided not to because the policing of superfluous laughter was too open to misinterpretation. People saying that isn't funny. Yes, that is funny. Particularly when you get into, for example, a black comedy like this week's Dream Home. You know, some people will find that satirical. Others will just find it repulsive.
A couple of HP7As before we move on. Robert in Edinburgh recently found that my addiction to saying hello to Jason Isaacs, even to people who wouldn't get the joke, has spread. I sat an Oxford entrance exam this week and suddenly found myself with an overwhelming compulsion, like an unstoppable force that I couldn't prevent. So at the end of my essay, I wrote the words, and hello to Jason Isaacs. This is an entrance exam for Oxford. Leading university, obviously, behind
Manchester.
Of course. I'm beginning to think in hindsight this wasn't perhaps the greatest choice I've ever made, but on the small chance that the marker may be a fellow Wittertainee, I may just be in luck.
Very good.
Let us know whether you're in or not. Connor McGregor, I've just seen Harry Potter 7 and I say I wasn't disappointed. The acting is great, as Radcliffe, Watson and Grint have improved film after film. I believe they are capable of competing with Hollywood giants. Ralph Fiennes as Voldemort is honestly the greatest villain in cinema history, says Connor. He is unbeatable in this film. We see how sinister Bellatrix Lestrange is and how evil she can be. The film has a very gloomy and dark atmosphere, and while David Yates isn't perfect, he gets the tone and realism brilliantly. The film will make money. It sets up the unforgettable finale, which is set to be, in capital letters,
unforgettable.
The finale to end all finales, and undoubtedly
unforgettable. That's what you are.
Okay, that's HP7A. The discussion to continue next week. What else is out that will get flattened?
Chico and Rita, an animated feature directed by Fernando Treba and Javier Mariscal. I loved some of Fernando Treba's previous work. He made, he won an Oscar for Belle Epoque, Oscar for Best Foreign Language Film. Before that, he made a very, very dark, weird, twisted, odd movie called The Mad Monkey, based on a novel, The Dream of the Mad Monkey, written by an English writer, but I believe writing in French, which starred Jeff Goldblum, Miranda Richardson, Dexter Fletcher, Lisa Walker. Very, very little scene there. I think there was three people in England who saw and liked that film, and me, Nigel Floyd and Tom Charity. Beyond that, it died a death.
Now, Nigel Floyd, we've kind of...
Yes, of this parish.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, and Tom Charity, she's used to write for Time Out. I mean, I remember that because the poster had three quotes on it, which was us three, and it was kind of like the Skyline thing. Everybody else just went, what on earth is all that about? It was released in America as Twisted Obsession, and didn't do any business there at all. The case of Chico and Rita, I mean, the extraordinary thing about Treba is if you put his work together, it's amazing that it's all made by the same guy. Javier Mariscal, of course, is a very, very famous designer. Chico and Rita is the story of a piano player and a singer who meet in Havana in the 1940s, and it's about the evolution of jazz music. It's about the evolution of their relationship. It's about the journey of that music to America, to the clubs of New York, how African rhythms come into jazz and turn it into something else. It's the musical supervisor, Bima Valdez, who's working to kind of one of the things they've done is they've re-recorded all the music themselves. They haven't used old recordings. They've, in the same way that when Ian Softley made Backbeat, for example, he decided the best way to do this that old musical sound was to get modern musicians to play that stuff. So here's the things that I really love about Chico and Rita, and I'm telling you, it's in my list of top 10 films of the year. I enjoyed it that much. Firstly, I think the design is beautiful. It's one of those animated features. When you look at it, I mean, it's obviously it's 2D animation. It has a beautiful sense of colour and sensuality to it. I mean, an awful lot of the time, sensuality is not something that's very easy to do in animation, perhaps. it tends to go, you know, fall over into something which is stylized and arch, but it's a genuinely sensual film. The dancing, the movement, I mean, obviously a certain amount of it is rotoscoping, but it is a film in which the screen bubbles with life and bubbles with, you know, with a really sort of tactile feel to it. It was lovely when I interviewed Javier Mariscal. He was saying that Rita, who's the central woman in the drama, when he was designing her and drawing her, he sort of fell in love with her, and he said he woke up in the middle of the night imagining her leaning over him saying, "Oh, thank you for the beautiful dress you have designed for me." And then he said, "I woke up and then she wasn't there, but she was there." And it's a very, very tactile animation. Second thing about it is the music's lovely. Obviously, it kind of it leads up to the creation of Buena Vista Social Club, and, you know, that whole explosion of that music which happened recently. I think if you know an awful lot about jazz, which I say straight off, I don't. I mean, my father is a huge jazz fan, and total, you know, Jelly Roll Morton aficionado, and that's something. I've never been a massive jazz fan, but in this, I felt I knew enough to really enjoy the film. And I'm sure if you know a lot more about it, there'd be much more in there that you get out of it. The story itself, however, is the real heart of it. In the end, it is a wonderful love story about this pianist and this singer who sort of fall in love, have a night of passion, and then are separated, and they're separated both by their careers and by the strange ebb and flow of the life that they lead. But we see the whole thing playing out in flashback. There's a sense of impending tragedy about it, and yet maybe just their passion for each other will somehow outlive that. And honestly, it's one of those films when I just sat there thinking, I'm really knocked out by just how full of life this film is. I'm really knocked out by the design of it. I'm really knocked out by the sound, the sensuality, the washing of it. I enjoyed it so much. And it was great because I've liked Trevor's work for a long time, and I've never sort of seen a group of films by him that all seemed to make sense as a group. And meeting him, talking to Javier Mariscal, it was lovely because they were every bit as devoted to the project as I want them to be. Also worth pointing out as a footnote, despite the fact this is a Spanish film, it is actually also funded by the Art of Man, by Cinemanx. So it is, weirdly enough, a Manx production. Who knew?
And yeah, it's Cinemanx.
Cinemanx. Not Cinemanx. That would be Manchester, wouldn't it? Cinemanx. All right, yeah. Cinemanx Films. Oh, I'm going to be back.
There's a new voice. A new voice has dawned. The Manx voice, hitherto
Manchester.
Suppressed.
Come over here to Cine Manx Films, yeah. Anyway, it's not, but it's lovely. It's really great. And even if you're not an animation fan, go see it. It's really, I mean, it's a more of a grown-up movie. It's not a kid's movie, it's a grown-up movie, but it's grown-up not in the way of Fritz the Cat or that kind of, you know, Heavy Traffic, that kind of grown-up. It's, you know, it's proper grown-up.
Ben Lyons, a Dundonian living in Morristown, New Jersey.
Not so from Manchester.
I'm an avid listener of the podcast, listen every Sunday morning whilst I do my long runs in Morristown, New Jersey. I'm moving up to running my first full marathon on Sunday in Philadelphia. And as an added boost, I was wondering if both of you could give me a giddy-up and shout at me to keep on moving. I have 4 hours of wittertainment saved up. If I get this right, you could give me some words of encouragement. I will potentially have less than 10 miles to go. So we say to Ben Lyons, giddy up.
Giddy up.
You're looking fine. Go on. See that person in front of you? They're wilting. They're not going to last as you, and they probably want to have a toilet break, and you don't.
Just
you
read
just
to
keep
me.
Going. Ben Lyons.
What does it say in the 15 certificate box that my eyesight won't read? It says Chico and Richard was 15-4.
Brief, strong sex and nudity.
Exactly.
You just wanted me to talk dirty, didn't you? That's what that was.
Don't get me to do that ever again. I've warned you about that before.
Is that what your show's going to be like tonight?
Well, brief, strong sex and nudity.
No wonder I'm not going to bring my kids along if it's going to be that.
There's going to be none of that. Are you coming? North Finchley Arts Centre.
I refer you to the answer.
It's round the corner from where you live.
Yeah, but I can't be bothered. Tom, on this email,
yes,
says, "I'm going to watch Harry Potter tonight with my mum, et al." He says, Tom, that's the rest
funny
of your
name.
Family,
yeah.
Really. That's, I would imagine.
Funny name for your mum.
"Looking forward to it, and I fully intend to say hello to Jason when he first appears. It's a small cinema, so I may get some odd looks."
Well, we should...
No talking, though.
No, but we should point out also the scene in which Jason first appears is dark, 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 dark. There is the hanging figure being tortured, you know, hanging... It's
the
weird.
The owner of the house, isn't it, I think?
It is worth pointing out that some of the darkness in it is quite dark. There is... I'm not giving anything away here because it's very near the beginning. When we first meet Voldemort and Snape and Lucius Malfoy, there is hanging over the table the figure of the owner of the house being hideously, and in a way which bizarrely recalls the spider walk from The Exorcist. I mean, clearly does. I'm not just imagining, clearly recalls that, or that rip-off film Abby. And it is genuinely creepy, didn't you think?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so I think probably at that point saying hello to Jason Isaacs would get you a...
You can wait. Well, you don't speak anyway, just wave.
Wave, but it will get you a slap in the face with a wet fish.
Steve in Coventry. I just got home from Harry Potter 7 Part 1. It has big problems. The trio seem to have regressed in terms of their acting abilities.
No!
The plot is messy and joltingly episodic. It's an email. You can't speak back.
No, I was asking Steve, you whether you agreed with
this. This is Steve's opinion.
Yeah, and I was asking whether you agree with Steve's opinion.
I'll finish it, and then I can... Can I get on?
It's your show.
Trio seem to have regressed in terms of their acting, but this is the plot is messy and joltingly episodic. There are jarring switches in tone, and the style of camera work is patchwork and irritating. It also ends not with a bang, but a whimper, but one which failed to hit any emotional note. There was also nowhere near enough Voldemort and Snape. However, the World War II metaphor, which the film is stuffed full of, works nicely in creating a sense of impending danger. Having said all of these faults, I can't say I was ever bored, and I'm looking forward to finally reaching the climax. Says Steve Glass in Coventry.
Patchwork camera work, no. But do you think that the cast have regressed in terms of their abilities?
No.
I thought Ron, Rupert Grint, was particularly strong this time.
It is, as you said, we played the clip earlier where you get loads of the adults, but that is basically it. It's all kids all the way through.
Kids in the woods. I mean, there's a real Hansel and Gretel thing going on in it. I mean, it does have that kind of archetypal gingerbread man feel to it. You know, it's kids lost in the woods. That is what's going on.
And the takeover of the dark side is very much, as Steve mentioned, it is a kind of like a word, it's the rise of fascism, isn't it? Certainly the graphics and the posters would indicate.
Yeah, and I think there's also there's a nod there to Terry Gilliam's Brazil in the way that the Ministry posters are all that very kind of constructivist look. It does recall Terry Gilliam's Brazil clearly.
This will continue, but there are a couple of films for which we do not have clips because they're in foreign.
They're in foreign, yes. So Uncle Boon Mee, who can recall his past lives, which won the Cannes Palme d'Or earlier on this year.
It's hard to tell where the title stopped. Can you just...
Uncle Boon Mee, who can recall his past lives, which won the Cannes Palme d'Or earlier this year when they...
Where was the full stop in that?
Uncle Boon Mee, who can recall his past lives, comma... which won the Cannes Palme d'Or earlier this year, which I thought was going to go to Mike Leigh, but then this came out of nowhere and then won everything. And once again, caught everybody by surprise. Let me give you a tip. If you have a film in competition in Cannes, right, and you want to win the Palme d'Or, here's what you do. You find my dates, the dates that I'm in Cannes, and you screen it either immediately before or immediately afterwards. For the last 3 years, that has been
the case. What does that say of your world standing?
Well, it tells you that I'm, you know, the plague.
Yes.
Exactly. No, that's fine. But I'm just saying, if anybody wants to win, all you need to know is Kermode in Cannes? If he is, you ain't going to win. Has Kermode left or has he not arrived yet? Yeah, in that case, you're in with a shout. So the story is Uncle Boon Mee, who actually, despite what the title says, can't recall his past lives, at least not immediately, is in a state of terminal illness. And he has a liver issue. His liver is being cleansed, but he is, you know, he is on the path between this life and the next. And whilst sitting down to a meal, his deceased wife appears at the table. She just literally fades in. They're all sitting around talking, and she just fades in. And then she's there as a real, tangible presence, and she talks to him from beyond the grave, but she is now living with him. And then a character appears, which is a full-grown monkey or gorilla with glowing eyes, which turns out to be what has happened to his son, who has mated with a ghost monkey. And then we go off into another sequence, which involves a princess, an aging princess, who has a strange erotic encounter with a fish, which I should point out the BBFC says scene takes place in a small lake with a woman floating on her back in the water, shot from the waist up, but her movements are not vigorous, but there is a brief shot of a catfish flapping about.
Well, you don't want that, do you?
No,
but it's, you really, you know, that would upset
it is
some
genuinely very strange. Here's what I like about the film.
Just on the catfish. Mm. What is happening there?
Okay, I don't think it's possible to explain in literal terms. Here are the things that I liked about it. Firstly,
is she fishing?
No. Well, I've never heard it called that before.
Okay.
In terms of the general tone, it reminded me, as you do an awful lot of this stuff, there is a
link. Does she use bait?
Can we not go there? Okay. There are things about it that if David
Lynch, have a license.
Shut up. Okay. David Lynch would love this movie, okay? Because there's an awful lot of it which actually is similar to the territory which he talked about in Twin Peaks: Far Walk With Me, in which it is, you know, we live inside a dream and the next world is immediately there, very tangible. The ghosts in the film exist in a very real and physical way, not as strange spectral apparitions, although they are both strange and spectral, but they are also strangely normalised. And effectively, what the film is about the moment of passing between life and death and the coexistence of this world and the next. And the best way of describing it is to say that it is a film which has a lightness of touch and a very upbeat approach towards death, a very upbeat approach towards the persistence of the soul in whatever format. I mean, to some extent, it's Tibetan Book of the Dead as done, you know, on screen. Obviously, there are moments in it that are, as I said, when I described that thing about there's the monkey with the glowing eyes and there's the woman having the relationship with the catfish, obviously, there are moments that could very, very easily tip over into just, you know, there was a point when I was watching it with the guy sitting in the monkey suit with the glowing eyes in which I thought, is it me or is this actually just completely absurd? And obviously, the absurdity is there, but as with all the David Lynch films, in which, for example, you have the small guy walking backwards and talking backwards, and meanwhile the log lady who comes in stroking a log and say, my log saw something last night, but now the owls are hooting in the trees. You can, if you want, choose to be derisive about it, but actually what I really liked
surely
about
not.
No, surely, but what I liked about the film was that it has a very gentle attitude towards its metaphysics. It is, in the best possible sense, a film about the good things about death. A film about the gap between this world and the next, the connection between this world and the next. It's very odd, it's very strange, it's very sensitively done with a sense of its own surrealism, but also keeping its feet firmly in what it considers to be a realistic tone. So even during the catfish and even during the monkey and even during all that stuff, it is all shot with the kind of the slightly flat, matter-of-fact eye of somebody for whom this stuff is not spectral and weird, but is strangely down to earth. I liked it very much.
James T from Ashford. We were talking to Thelma Schoonmaker earlier about Peeping Tom, which is back out. Great news, he says, about Peeping Tom. It was shown during a film studies thing at school. I really enjoyed it. Hopefully we'll get the recognition it deserves and Michael Bay will not try and remake it. Great to hear Thelma Schoonmaker on the show. So I'll give a lecture at my university, Canterbury Christchurch, as the Film, Radio and Television Studies building is named after Michael Powell. She is one of the greatest editors working today and I could listen to her talk for hours. Also, you might like to know, I went to see Harry Potter at my local World of Cine this morning. Really enjoyed it. Feel from what reviews I've read, critics have been a bit harsh on it. Also managed to stop myself from saying hello to Jason in keeping with the code of conduct.
Well,
James,
done.
Thank you. One more.
Scorsese finally saw Peeping Tom when it was shown to him by a Hollywood executive who wanted to remake it. They sat, watched the film, and the Hollywood executive, to his great credit, went, well, you can't top that. Also out this week, a Hong Kong movie, Dream Home, Pang Ho Chung film. It's 18 certificate. The BBFC thinks it contains absolutely everything. It says the film reaches the adult category in the opening moment. Particularly nasty murders, surreal over-the-top CGI special effects and black humour, but lingering on victims' pains, lashing of gore. Story is...
Does it have any fish?
No, it doesn't have any fish. The story is, the director says that, and this is the key statement here at the beginning of the film, if Hong Kong is an island surrounded by harbours and sea, how come the price of a sea view apartment, even one less than 400 square feet, is so damn high? It's the story of a girl who grows up in an area in which the property isn't worth anything, looking over the harbour. Then, of course, property developers come in. She can no longer afford to live in a sea view apartment which she wants to live in. So, in order to affect the property prices, in order to make the property acceptable to her, she commits a series, and I mean a series, of increasingly, and I mean increasingly grisly, and I don't use that word lightly, Category 3 style murders. Now, if you know anything about Hong Kong Category 3 movies, basically they're kind of full-on exploitation movies, sex, gore, violence, you know, everything cranked up, and often with a very, very strong underlying satirical theme of black humour. There's an element of, you know, how yuck can you go?
And how yuck does it
go? It's pretty yuck. It is pretty yuck. In some places it's profoundly distasteful, in other places it's comically horrid. There are moments of sort of, you know, some of the gore in it you think, oh, that's quite funny. Some of the gore in it you think, really, I don't want that now on the, I don't want to be watching it. But this is what these Hong Kong Category 3 movies look like. Underpinning the whole thing, and this is why I was saying about the inappropriate laughter thing, is the key to many of these films is that they are, in the end, satires. They are satirical. They are black humour. And the thing is, in the end, a gag about property prices. The tagline is, they wouldn't slash the price, so she slashed them. And that's the tone of the film. A darkly comic, violent, gory, unpleasant, quite often leering and really quite nasty 18 certificate movie with a strong undercurrent of property satire.
Didn't they just want to think, I don't know, let's make a really nasty film, but we'll kind of put that satire in just so that critics will go, ah, well, there's more to it, you know.
You might think that, Simon.
Yes.
If you came along to North Finchley tonight, you'd hear otherwise.
Alistair in Huddersfield. I don't get peeping.
Alistair.
I don't get peeping, Tom. Why is Mark in the film inexplicably German when he's from an English family?
Yeah, I know. Yes, never explained. He's meant to be doing English. He does sound like Werner Herzog. It's a shame he's Bavarian.
And the movie of the week.
Well, it's a tie.
It's Harry Potter.
Harry, Chico and Rita, Tom. Harry, Chico, Rita and Tom is the film of the week.
For everyone, it's Harry Potter.
Harry, Chico, Rita and Tom.
OK. Thank you very much indeed for listening. Don't forget, you can download the Code of Conduct. Go to the front of the BBC Five Live website. You can click on the link. And hey, presto, it's a poster.
On digital and online. This is BBC Radio 5 Live.
bbc.co.uk/5live.
Hello, me again. To watch my latest reviews, head to www.bbc.co.uk/Mark Kermode and check out my blog, Kermode Uncut.